sorry. Thank you for the opportunity of speaking at this meeting. The title of this talk refers to a theory at the future boundary of eternal inflation. Now, the theory, of course, is not constructed, and some people think that it doesn't make sense to talk about it. However, what this theory is the theory of the asymptotic wave function of the universe. And if that makes sense, then it should be that theory. It does seem to make sense to talk about the asymptotic wave function of the Sitter space, at least perturbatively, at tree level. And so, who knows, there may be hope that there is such thing as a formulation of quantum gravity in terms of such future boundary. So, a lot of you in the audience know a lot more than I do about all of this. So, unlike some of the previous talks, I would encourage you to stop and speak so we may all learn something from that. My job here is just to tell the story of why we got interested in that. When I say we, I mean with Alex Belenkin, with whom we discussed of this subject a little bit. And it was motivated by the measure problem. my mission is just to be frank about what we know and we don't, as Neil Turok asked in his opening comments. There are a lot of things that may go wrong with inflation. Let's first indulge in the successes. Inflation is a great theory. It made a number of predictions which have checked out and didn't have to. One more may soon be available. Maybe tensor modes may be detected soon. And funny thing is that all of this is explained by very simple potentials, such as the potential of a harmonic oscillator. This, as far as I understand, explains all existing data. And so from a traditional phenomenological point of view, this would be a successful model. But somehow we know that it is not, because it has a Pauls membrane problem. It would recur at the potential, maybe creating small islands which look nothing like our universe. And so we conclude that maybe there have to be other vacua to which this can tunnel to avoid Pauls membrane problem. No matter what, we are led to consider the fact that that inflation is generically eternal, as many people discussed before, either due to the existence, I mean, as Ben rigorized in his talk yesterday, either due to the existence of at least one metastable BS vacuum, or due to diffusion high up in the potential. This was recognized early on, and people started thinking about possible ways out of that, ways to regularize the infinities that that come with it. The mechanism of eternal inflation has been reviewed. We don't expect just a few vacua, but maybe a myriad of them. Raphael was appealing to the large number of vacua just a moment ago. To just be frank, again, there are things that we don't understand about the physics of vacuum decay. I mean, we sort of have some intuition that vacuum will decay, but I don't think there exists a rigorous theory of vacuum decay in the Sitter space. And in fact, this afternoon, somebody is going to give a critical review of this subject. Ben Schler is going to talk about that. with his own personal take. We say that we can jump from a low energy DS vacuo to a high DS vacuo, things like that. These are things we don't understand very well. Maybe a full quantum theory of gravity might shed light on these subjects. That's one reason for looking at holographic theories of various sorts, and a future boundary theory might be one of them. This is how space-time is supposed to look in a causal diagram. It has all these pockets which can be classified in inflating and terminal. Terminal can be of a negative cosmological constant and lead to crunches, which we don't know how to describe at all. And stable Minkowski vacua, which some people here are striving to describe through a boundary theory. The space-time structure is far more complicated than it is drawn here, generically, because in addition to transitions between vacua of the same dimensionality, we also have transdimensional transitions, which complicate the subject. Stanford group is concentrating on a 2D theory at the boundary of a Minkowski hat, which is four-dimensional, but who says that there aren't Minkowski stable vacua with other dimensions, whose boundary would then not be two-dimensional. It would be maybe higher dimensional or lower dimensional. So there's a number of things that are not contemplated in the usual discussions. And this afternoon we have a chance to hear also about these transdimensional transitions by Jose Blanco Pillado. In spite of all this, we do think that inflation, or eternal inflation, has one nice feature, which is that it has a volume distribution which reaches an attractor. And the volume distribution is just governed by a rate equation, which leads to stationary distribution at late times, which is, I don't have a pointer. I don't know if there is one. Help me to point. Thank you. This one? Okay, so what this rate equation tells us is that if you have some irreducible set of vacua which can transit to each other by sequence of a finite sequence of transitions, then there is a sort of a unique eigenvalue of that rate equation matrix, and the asymptotic volume distribution is fixed. And because of that, there is a sort of a correspondence between the theory and the multiverse it gives rise to. And the problem that we face is, of course, comparing the numbers of events of different types in this structure. And as many people pointed out, and even this morning after Jim's talk, the problem is the inhomogeneity of this self-similar fractal. Now, the looks of this fractal already prompted a measure which is sort of based on the boundary. Okay, so early on, 7 years ago, we suggested that one way to compare the abundances of the different types of vacua is just to set up a cutoff in the size at the future boundary. The future boundary is sort of the place where everything has happened already. And we may just say, okay, so let's take a coarse graining scale here at the boundary, and then any bubbles which are bigger than that coarse graining scale will be counted, and the ones that are smaller will not be counted. And then this becomes a finite number for each type, and we can assign probabilities dividing those numbers. And we thought this was promising because then inside each one of these bubbles we have homogeneity, and we can apply a prescription similar to what Jim was saying of taking a random Hubble volume inside of each one of them to, you know, calculate probabilities with that. Naively this works, but then Alan pointed out a number of problems with this bucket-based measure, such as the fact that you can have soft transitions, which create sort of soft bubbles, which sort of disrupt this homogeneity in ways which are hard to account for. Okay, so this was just a very naive attempt, but it was already based on, on this future boundary point of view. Now, a more typical way of cutting off is perhaps this one, which has been discussed here at this meeting several times, which is to start with some initial surface, end up orthogonal congruences, let time run, and then after some time we stop. This leads to a finite distribution from which we can draw probabilities. The distribution does not depend on the choice of hypersurfaces, but it does depend on what we use as the clock. This is sort of illustrated here. The shape of the surface is different. The numbers are different. And people did phenomenology of different cutoff prescriptions. Some of them have very obvious problems, such as the well-known Young-Jungian paradox, which tells us that we should be early on with super exponential probability, and this leads to contradictions, of course. This pocket-based measure, which I discussed just a minute ago, has several problems, many more than can be written here. There are measures which behave very well phenomenologically, such as the scale factor measure, at least as far as these naive paradoxes are concerned. But I hear that even the scale factor measure is problematic to the minds of some of us here. I think Vitaly Banchurin is going to talk about some of these theoretical problems that the scale factor measure may have. But So this is sort of the situation with cutoff measures. I mean, some people are not that happy with them. I mean, it isn't clear whether they can be sensible at all, as Vitaly, I think, will discuss at length. Now, because of this situation, we decided to take a radical new point of view, which is motivated by the following, that in the causal diagram, the problem is reminiscent of a UV problem in field theory because it's due to late bubbles, which look very small at the feature boundary. The number of events diverges as we consider smaller bubbles. The number of events is regularly dependent. Okay, so these are all words that are familiar from certain field theories where we have divergences which are regularly dependent, and we thought something might be learned from a field theory boundary point of view. And so we explored this proposal that the dynamics of eternal inflation may admit a holographic description, as I said, in terms of field theory at the boundary. So this is not all that original. It is basically a rotation of ADS-CFT, morally. So in ADS-CFT, we say that the partition function is the partition function in the ADS bulk is the exponential of the effective action of a CFT. If we try a similar statement for a path integral in Lorentzian. That path integral in Lorentzian already has a name. It's the wave function of the universe. And we can explore whether this looks like the exponential of effective action of a conformal field theory. We can explore that of course, not in full generality, but we can do some simple exercises, such as considering gravitons in pure de Sitter space, or in the case where we have vacuum transitions, we can consider the dynamics of bubble fluctuations and how that looks from the point of view of the boundary. So this is familiar to all of you, and very elementary, but okay, maybe even that is a stretch, I don't know. So so this is the Sitter space, this is the scale factor. Here is graviton configuration, expanded in momentum modes. Now the Gaussian wave function for that, that solves the Schrödinger equation in the background of the Sitter space is given by this expression. So this is the amplitude of mode k, and the coefficient is given by a solution of the mode equation, which is negative frequency, logarithmic derivative of that. Now, to specify the wave function, we have to choose some vacuum. We tend to work in the Bunch-Davis vacuum, which is adiabatic at early times, in the free theory. And just by plugging this Bunch-Davis mode in this expression, we get this result. And I'm writing this in five dimensions. I'm writing it in five dimensions just because, you know, it leads to a more interesting discussion, maybe, over here, and closer also to ADS-CFT. Okay. So what one gets for the phase of the wave function is an expression which has terms which diverge with a scale factor, such as this one here and this one here. Okay. And then it has terms that go away as the scale factor goes to infinity. Now, a term like this has the looks of a kinetic term for the graviton, with a divergent coefficient in front. Okay. Here there is a term which looks like a non-local piece, if I interpret this as an effective field theory, an effective action. And this effective action has some imaginary piece, which accompanies the non-local term. They are grouped together, and they share the same coefficient. And usually in cosmological perturbation theory, I mean, there are many cosmologists here who have done this many times, we don't see this logarithmic piece because when we mod square the wave function, this disappears, and we just get something like that, where the variance of the gravitons can be read from. So this is the scale invariant power spectrum of gravitons, okay? Now, in the expression, there was also the non-local piece that I referred to, which has these looks. And now, instead of the scale factor, I wrote this mu, just to phrase it in the language of a renormalization scale. Okay, so this scale mu is A times H, is what you could call the inverse commoving horizon size, or the scale at which the modes get frozen. Okay, so in other words, this is an expression which is valid for frozen modes. When the mode freezes in, it enters this description. Okay, and this is what sets the cutoff scale of this CFT description. This is the form expected in a conformal field theory. I mean, if I interpret this as a conformal field theory, indeed it has to have this logarithmic divergent piece, and this is very familiar from ADS-CFT. The correlator of energy momentum tensor can be calculated taking two derivatives of the effective action with respect to the metric. So I take two derivatives here, I get this correlator, which is the Fourier transform of 1 over x to the 8, basically, which is the TT correlator in four dimensions. And what I wanted to say is that the coefficient of the logarithmically divergent term, which gives rise to this TT correlator in this case, is the trace anomaly. Okay. Here I write the trace anomaly in four dimensions. It has two pieces. One is the integral of the Weyl tensor square, and the other is just the Euler characteristic. If I match this anomaly to my logarithmically divergent piece, I see that this coefficient, which is usually referred to as the central charge, is given by h minus 3. Okay, so this is interpreted as the fact that h minus 3 degrees of freedom contribute to this conformal field theory. That's the number of degrees of freedom of the field theory, basically. Now, now from this perturbative argument, I can only match one of these two coefficients that appear in the conformal anomaly, because the other one is a topological invariant, which is not affected by fluctuations. Okay. So, the coefficient C2 I cannot match, and in principle, it depends on the theory of quantum gravity that I am using, because it depends on non-perturbative features. If my theory of quantum gravity at the semi-classical level is the Hartle-Hawking wave function, then I can determine what this C2 is, and this can be done in some easy way, just rotating the result that we obtain in ADS for the classical action with a boundary metric G on the hyperbolic space, and with some Euclidean rotations of negative to positive cosmological constant, which is this rotation here, and with a rotation also of the holographic coordinate Z, which is used in ADS to I eta, where eta is conformal time in the theta. This ADS partition function, as I said, rotates to the wave function. And it is quite easy to show, as Maldacena recently pointed out, that then the square mod function of this state is given in terms of just the exponential of the trace anomaly. Okay, and this is kind of very neat and somewhat unexpected, because the effective action itself is non-local, but mod square of it is local, okay? And so probabilities are given in terms of a local expression at the future boundary. Now, this argument is at large n. We're just doing three-level calculation in the ADS. And this should correspond to perturbative computations in the neighborhood of the sitter solution after rotation. And it should be sufficient to compute endpoint correlators of the graviton. At three level. So, this does not include loops, but just by using this wave function, one can compute any endpoint correlator, spectrum by spectrum, all forms of non-Gaussianity. In fact, the form of, we don't have to speak about non-Gaussianity characterizing it by the endpoint functions, because this is already the wave function, so it's completely characterized by that. This is an example of a boundary theory, and it's only a three-level boundary theory, but it's very nice because, it includes only local pieces. The expression is Weyl invariant, it seems to suggest that the boundary theory of the universe is a Weyl invariant theory, okay? Now, there is a technical complication with that, because in order to compute any observable, such as an endpoint function of some object, such as the matrix, say, in this case, what we need to do is integrate over this matrix with the wave function square and then the number of insertions that we may want to compute. And, yeah, although this object is bilinvariant, that is at tree level, and I think it has to be also at... sorry, maybe I should say it differently. Although this is bilinvariant at tree level, the measure typically contains an anomaly. Okay, so... to put it... to put it more precisely, this wave function can be thought of as generated by a conformal field theory and its complex conjugate by doubling of the theory with opposite central charge. And the central charges of the field theory degrees of freedom add up to zero, but then we have to integrate over matrix, and this integration has to be has to respect the real invariance. And it is not clear to me, I don't know if this is known, whether there is any guarantee that one can construct a bilinvariant theory in this way. Nonetheless, I think this expression, which expresses the probability for a sheaf of configurations, should be bilinvariant because of causality. Okay, so this is the wave function for long wavelength modes, and once the modes are frozen, what had to happen has already happened, and probabilities cannot change. Okay, there's nothing you can do to change the probability when something has gone out of the horizon. And so this measure should reflect this fact by bilinvariance, because the time translation and superhorizon scales is just a real transformation of this boundary theory. So the fact that that this is local is peculiar to odd bulk dimensions. So if you take just four dimensions, then the same exercise leads to this type of effective action. Here, the imaginary part that contributed to the mod psi square comes from a non-analytic piece, and we cannot express mod psi square in terms of local expression at the feature boundary. Okay, in this case, the number of fields is H minus 2, and this coincides with the entropy of horizon size region, as you all know. Now, this was for the case of pure de Sitter space, and it is perhaps not surprising that it has a CFT flavor. In fact, it's just inherited from ADS by the rotation of these two parameters. Now, one may ask, what happens if we introduce transitions? What kind of a flavor does that have in terms of a CFT? So we can consider a simple model of DS bubbles separated by thin walls. Now, in that case, we can take a flat surface cutting through these walls. This can be done, as illustrated in this diagram. We have different vacuum energies on both sides, but still we can cut that with a flat surface. And so here we have, you know, surfaces where this dual CFT can live. What we have then in one of these slices is a picture like that, where we have different de Sitter vacua with different central charges, and the location of the domain walls becomes in this CFT locus, becomes a defect that separates a region with different central charges. Okay. Now, the effective action should reflect the fact that that the degrees of freedom, the CFT degrees of freedom, see a boundary, interact with a boundary, and so it should depend on the shape of the surfaces that separate these regions. Now, the exercise that we did for gravitons, we can repeat for bubble fluctuations. And here I'm just going to present the result of a calculation which is done in the Goldstone limit, where the dynamics is not dominated by gravity. The dynamics of bubble fluctuations is not dominated by gravity. And the same exercise can be done in the Banks-Davis vacuum again. Now we use the closed chart of the Sitter space in the lower dimensional world sheet, just so we can get a little bit more handle on the structure of it. And for the membrane, that is in a bubble in four dimensions, what we get is a structure like that. Okay, so this would be the normal displacement of the bubble. The effective action looks a little bit similar to what we had before. You see here a kinetic term for this Goldstone. We have pieces, so this delta would be the Laplacian. This is a term which is k to the 4 kind of term, accompanying a logarithm. Okay, so this has to be related to the anomaly introduced by a deformation of the shape of this defect, okay, in CFT language. So, sure enough, when we express this in terms of the, maybe I should say, this phi is the normal displacement of the world sheet, which we have to project on the flat surface, so that at the future boundary, what we see is not this phi, but this delta r, and I'm going to call this delta r over r, delta, small delta. And now I'm looking at the effective action for this deformation. And what we see is that the coefficient of the logarithmically divergent term indeed takes a form which is consistent with the expected anomaly created by such a defect on a CFT. It has also two pieces, one which is constructed out of the extrinsic curvature of the defect, and this is the only one that we probe by means of a perturbative analysis. But in this anomaly, there is also a non-perturbative piece, okay? And what this non-perturbative piece is again the Euler characteristic of this defect at the future boundary. And so, although I don't get it from this perturbative calculation, I know what is the interpretation of this D2. This D2 has to be the tunneling rate, okay? Because introducing one of these defects is due to the fact that the bubble nucleated in the past. Okay, so from this CFT point of view, this has to be the tunneling rate. And the reason why this might be interesting is because, as I said, there are questions of whether certain types of bubbles can nucleate or cannot nucleate. And maybe from this field theory point of view, if we knew something, some properties of the CFT that we're looking at, we could determine those coefficients. And if there is nothing wrong with them, that seems to suggest that this type of defects can exist, and consequently, the corresponding type of bubbles can nucleate. Okay. Okay. So, so just to conclude, I mentioned that this was motivated by the measure problem. So all I have to say that is about that is that holography may suggest a guess for certain types of global cutoff measures. Okay, and the first attempt at using this boundary theory to make a guess about the global cutoff measure, our first guess was that it would be the scale factor cutoff, and the reason is that we used a very naive approach, which maybe is correct, maybe it isn't, I'm not sure. But it has been criticized by Rafael, and just, mostly embraced, but yeah. So the point of view, the naive point of view that leads to this scale factor cutoff is the following. Anything we do has consequences, and those get imprinted at the future boundary. Okay. So all the information, everything that happens on sub-horizon scales, is eventually encoded in the form of long wavelength modes. No information remains on sub-horizon scales until we reach the future boundary, and this is just due to the thermalization theorems. Okay, so you can have a hard drive with a lot of information, but if you wait long enough, all that information has to flow to long wavelength modes and eventually find its way at the future boundary. So, you know, things that happen earlier will look bigger at the future boundary. Things that happen later will look smaller. But the same type of event, will be recorded according to its scale factor time, just because the wavelength of what's emitted redshifts like scale factor. That was the logic. But then what Rafael said, and he has a point, is that this discriminates against small people. I'm not interested in that. And because, I mean, if you have a dwarf and a giant doing the same thing, and at speed proportional to their size, the signal that they project at the future boundary, roughly speaking, is bigger for the giant than it is for the dwarf. And so with a fixed cutoff, the giant may be counted when the dwarf isn't. Okay. Maybe a counter-argument to that is that this is not exactly true, because the local physics is not scale invariant, and the effect of the dwarf and the effect of the giant will not be the same even if we scale them. Okay. So, I mean, the imprint of the future boundary will not be exactly the same. Anyway, the second approach, which was basically what Rafael suggested instead, is that we should use the commoving horizon cutoff, which is similar to what I discussed before for counting bubbles, except that Rafael pointed out that this may be of general validity. And the argument is, so commoving horizon cutoff is what Rafael calls light cone time, okay? And the idea is that we take the future boundary and we sprinkle points at equal distances, and then we try to match the degrees of freedom of this boundary theory, which we said where they were given Schrödinger entropy per point, okay? So the central charge per point. And then look at a cutoff surface which has the same number of degrees of freedom per point. Okay, and that cutoff surface has the property that the commoving horizon is constant along the surface. Okay, now Alex Belenkin recently pointed out that for the counting of the degrees of freedom in the bulk, it is not the causal horizon that is relevant, but it is the apparent horizon that is relevant. And this coincides with the scale at which the modes freeze. So that's basically the point. And all of these possibilities, say scale factor, light cone time, and apparent horizon, they're all in the same family. Okay. They do not differ that much from one another. I'd say that, or I'm told by Mike Salem, that the scale factor is the one that fares better in phenomenology. Light cone time, as Rafael pointed out, has this runaway behavior towards small lambda. And that's easy to understand because we're cutting off at the energy scale, which is A times H, okay? So in places where H is bigger, A has to be larger. So we go further to the future and we include more events, okay? And that's, I think, the difference, the basic difference between a scale factor cutoff and a commoving horizon cutoff, which causes this degeneracy here. And this third possibility pointed out by Alex just a couple of weeks ago, or maybe more, is sort of intermediate between both. It doesn't sort of alter the cutoff as much as this one at low age. But this may be due to some difficulty which is encountered in implementing this commoving horizon cutoff. So let me just call it CAH. The A is for apparent. I think the philosophy is correct. It is the apparent horizon that dictates the number of degrees of freedom. Okay. But it is also true that surfaces of commoving apparent horizon are not space-like in general. And we want the argument of the wave function to be a space-like surface. And so we have to sort of tamper with this surface to make it space-like. And the surface is modified by a prescription, which is called plus. Okay. So this CAH plus seems to fare a little better with regard to this runaway than the CH prescription or the light cone prescription. Now, now the reason this CH plus may be a little bit strange is because of the following. So if we are... if we meet Minkowski bubble, so say outside the space is the sitter, and this is a surface of constant A times H. H is constant outside. Okay. As we jump inside, the apparent horizon is constant on surfaces that go like that. In fact, this is just A dot. Okay. So during inflation, A dot grows, but as we reach the surface of thermalization, A dot decreases, and then this is the point where the surface goes time-like, actually. It creates some sort of onion here. This would be actually the surface of constant apparent horizon, commoving apparent horizon size. And the way to understand this is very simple. So we have a mode which is sub-horizon. At a certain point, it crosses the horizon, and it has reached then the cutoff. It can be counted. So then we have inflation. But at some point, this mode re-enters the horizon. If this is a very low age, say this is age equal to zero, suppose the universe was flat. So modes exit the horizon and re-enter the horizon. And that's the reason for this shape. Okay. So now this surface is not space-like. And so one cannot really advocate a duality of this form because wave function should be defined on a space-like surface. So something has to be done about that, and what Alex suggested was removing all events which are at the future of this strange-looking surface, and then it becomes something like that. And because this contains less mass than this, which is what Raphael would use. Okay, this contains less mass. It has less of a problem over here. Okay. Sorry. Ah, no. Wait. Feature. Yeah. Okay. So it's a feature. But I mean, I'm just trying to explain the difference between the two. Yeah. So. Well, I think you mentioned that this may be solved by the number of states or the number of vacuum in the landscape, or it had something to do with that. Yeah. I didn't mean to say it is a problem, but So this seems to have no need for this assumption. But then again, I mean, it's somewhat artificial because I mean, an alternative would be to instead of removing everything to the future, it would be including everything to the past, and then you would have a similar problem. You know, so there's some. So I mean, maybe what I should say to summarize this is that this holographic inspiration has not really served to completely fix the measure so far. So that's very much an open issue. But it does seem to point in the direction of measures related to the scale factor cutoff. Okay. Now, I think. Mother time, yeah? Thank you. So just on an amusing tone, I mean, what the boundary theory may seem fascinating to say is about the problem of virtual Boltzmann brains. I mean, some people have suggested that you can have a virtual Boltzmann brain, even in Minkowski space, and that this creates a problem for the measure. Okay. So in other words, what they say is that the vacuum can think. Okay. So this may sound strange to some of you, but to some other ones of you, this seems to be a strong problem. Now, from the boundary theory perspective, there is no such thing as a virtual Boltzmann brain. I mean, this doesn't send any signals to the future boundary. There is no interaction whatsoever. I mean, this thing pops in and out of existence, but without leaving any trace whatsoever that can escape to any boundary, future or now or of any type. Okay. So, if nothing else, this seems to be a hard, you know, consequence of thinking in terms of a boundary theory as opposed to a bulk theory. So, this is just a concluding summary, which I don't think says anything that I haven't said yet. Thank you.
Questions?
Yeah, I guess I maybe I can just comment on this on the
yes,
discussion
please.
We had a minute ago. So I think that we could probably agree that the phenomenological differences between the proposals that are in the family that I think we all like are probably at this point not conclusive enough to really help us sort things out to any more. In fact, it's not completely clear to me that we can sort things out to much better detail at the level of approximation that we can hope these things to work.
I agree.
The reason that I have a certain bias towards, I guess, the causal pattern and light cone time is that are really formal reasons. One is that with anything like the scale factor measure or the new measure that Alex proposed, we need these extra fixes, these ad hoc fixes that help us sort out what to do when the scale factor A or A dot starts decreasing, and we, you know, and the sort of zeroth order rule doesn't give us a well-defined answer anymore, and you know, if the causal patch does not have that particular problem. The second formal reason why I think it's of great interest is that if you implement the idea that you and Alex proposed of getting a preferred global cutoff from some kind of analogy with the UVIR correspondence of ADS-CFT, if you implement that in the way that I suggested, the Likert time cutoff gives you exactly equivalent answer. So there's an exact duality, really something that I thought was very surprising, at least to me, between this global picture and global cutoff and the causal patch cutoff, both of which sort of are motivated by different aspects of holography, but when you look at them the first time, you know, there's no reason why they would seem to have anything to do with each other. So those things are not, again, they're probably not conclusive either, but I think there's something going on there that didn't have to happen that suggests that maybe we're zooming in into the right direction.
Yeah. May I comment on your comment? Okay, so of course causal patch is very nice, you see, the horizon is not determined until we know the whole history, right? So it's also somewhat a schizophrenic point of view. The other thing is that, as I said, I mean, say with a census taker, I mean, you say it's equivalent, but before we get to census taker. You say it's equivalent, but it depends on some initial distribution of these guys that you send to explore. which does not seem to be necessary in the global picture, because, you know, there you have a first sample, or this theory of quantum gravity will tell you.
That's completely true. I mean, the non-trivial statement is that it's possible to find a very simple initial condition for the causal patch under which you are equivalent.
It is simple, that in itself is but Rafael, you will agree that it's simple in simple cases, but it may get complicated in general. Sorry? Right, but I mean, maybe it's simple in the context of four dimensions and, you know, with certain, you know. So, so I mean, say if you have Minkowski vacuum, I think you run into some conceptual problems with that, because, and then you have to switch maybe to a census taker. So, I mean, how these things will fit together, if they do, I think it's anybody's guess at this time.
So as a non-expert in these discussions of which measure works or which cutoff works best, I have wondered whether it sounds from a distance kind of like trying to decide whether dimensional regularization is correct or whether Pauli-Villars is correct. And at the end of the day, nowadays we don't think that's the right question. And what you want to look at is not, you know, how to, the key thing is to find the renormalized theory and calculate quantities that don't depend on the regulator. Is there any possibility that it could go that way with eternal inflation too?
It may. It may. The problem is that we're so far from understanding the boundary theory, what I call the boundary theory, or maybe some other people have other ideas of what the boundary theory may be, but I mean, we're so far away that, there are probably, there are for sure many people who can answer this question better in this room. But I mean,
another way to say it is that
Okay, in my view, this problem is not going to be solved anytime soon in this way, as a field theory problem, just because, the theory is complicated. I mean, Lenny says that that he knows how to deal with two-dimensional quantum gravity, but is this going to be enough to understand the multiverse? We don't know. And, if it's harder, then it's harder, and there's nothing we can do about it, you know. So, yeah. But it's exciting anyways, because, I mean, I think we can all learn from that. I mean, I, for one, am quite excited and I'm warming up to learning more about this.
But in other words, I guess the question is whether the fruitful discussion is which regulators have the best properties, if at the end of the day what one wants are quantities that are regulator independent.
Yeah, I think that's one way of putting it, yeah. It could be that we find a way to regulate this theory, which is sort of universal, and in this sense, things will be regularly independent. So I was making reference to the fact that the theory might be well invariant. So of course, I have no clue if it is or it is not, but if it is, then this might tell you something about how you should regulate that. I don't know how to regulate a well invariant theory myself, but to the gravity seems to be well invariant, and there's a way of regulating it. So it could be that that this can be done in general. Yeah.
Okay, I think we should thank Jama again.